this morning. Francisco Carrion versus Kim Buck.
Good morning. May it please the court. We briefed a number of grounds on which this court could reverse Mr. Carrion's conviction for first-degree murder. Today I want to focus on two which are closely related: due process and ineffective assistance. And I want to start with a concrete example of why due process matters here. During his alleged confession, Mr. Carrion was asked, "Well, you went in there to take something, right?" And Officer Degaldillo, the investigating officer who translated for Mr. Carrion, translated Mr. Carrion's response as, "Well, I don't know. If I went in there, if I saw something, maybe I would like to take." And then he was cut off. The trial court noted this alleged confession as part of its most compelling evidence of Mr. Carrion's intent to commit a theft. The court then went on to discuss the corroborating, or what it considered corroborating, circumstantial evidence, which it believed corroborated the confession. But in contrast to this translation or this interpretation, the defense called Ms. Ramos, a certified interpreter, who testified that Carrion actually said, "I don't even know what I was going to do when I went in there." There is no intent to steal in what Mr. Carrion actually said in the exchange, and what was correctly translated by Ms. Ramos. But the court did not take that into consideration. And the problems caused by the state acting as Mr. Carrion's interpreter are immediately obvious. The inaccuracy of the translation undercuts the judge's most compelling evidence of intent. Indeed, the inaccuracy suggests an admission where there was none. A confession of intent to steal cannot be voluntary when the defendant never even said what the interpreter interpreted. It is obviously well established that the voluntariness of a confession must be evaluated separately from its truth or falsity, and that that evaluation must be done independently of any corroborating facts, but that was not done here. Indeed, the judge relied on what he considered to be circumstantial evidence to support his reliance on the confession, but did not evaluate the voluntariness of the confession independently of those circumstantial facts. To be clear, Mr. Carrion's confession was videotaped to be used against him at trial, but he was not given the minimal protections he would have received at trial, most notably a neutral, qualified interpreter. That omission...
So what he did testify is that he went in there with the woman.
Yes, Your Honor. He was in the woman's house.
And she was stabbed.
Yes, she was stabbed. That is correct. To the result of that, though, the question becomes whether he should have been charged with and convicted of first-degree murder or second-degree. It is our contention that the circumstantial evidence does not support the first-degree murder. Instead, should have been taken down to second-degree. The omissions, the grammatical errors, the problems with the translation, and the bias inherent in having the state act as Mr. Carrion's interpreter have caused significant questions as to the voluntariness of that confession.
Well, in his federal habeas petition, he doesn't really make any reference to the interpreter and issues with the interpreter.
In his federal habeas petition, he refers to the insufficient evidence for the finding of residential burglary.
Right.
And that finding was largely, or was the most compelling evidence, according to the trial court judge.
Right, but it doesn't specifically identify the identity of the interpreter and the problem that that was the investigating officer and investigating officer. That's not in there. So isn't that waived?
You're correct that that specific piece of information is not in his federal habeas petition. But what we have here is a prisoner working through what he calls a PAL, a prison administrator legal assistant. And what Mr. Carrion did was cite to his Finley motion, which does include that factual allegation, in his federal habeas petition. So while he, as a prisoner, did not correctly include all the necessary facts, he did cite to his Finley petition, which did include the, that
factual. What about his state court attorneys? Did they make any reference to the interpreter in the videotape confession?
In his direct appeal, in the Anders brief that was filed by the state court, they questioned the reasonable doubt of residential burglary, and again, did include the question of sufficiency of evidence,
right,
and due
not,
process.
Not an attack on the interpreter.
The court or the state-appointed appellate counsel did reference or include the fact that Officer Degladillo acted as the interpreter,
right, but didn't challenge that. And then the actual confession was not really challenged by the defendant in terms of it being a verbatim of what the defendant had said, correct?
There are two points to what you're saying. And to the first, the verbatim versus not verbatim, Your Honor, the professional interpreter both testified that it was verbatim, mm-hmm, and that there are omissions and grammatical errors. And we believe that those two things are not possible together. And it seems that the interpreter was testifying that generally, yes, the questions and answers were translated verbatim, but that in the specifics, and I gave you, I started off with one example, there were omissions and grammatical errors which significantly affect the substance of what was said.
Okay, thank you.
And that, your question, Your Honor, lead to the second point, and this is why I mentioned that they are closely related, the ineffective assistance of counsel. At each step of the way, counsel pled facts supporting the claims that we are bringing today, that the confession was involuntary, but never actually took the next logical and obvious step to challenge that confession. So in the Anders brief, in the Finley brief, these facts were alleged, but the arguments were not made. And with that, Your Honors, I would rest and reserve my time for rebuttal, but request that this court would find that Mr. Carrion's conviction should have been excluded, and that his counsel was ineffective in not seeking for it to be so. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. Ms. Stotus?
May it please the court, counsel, Rita Stotz from the Attorney General's Office for the respondent. All three of petitioners'
claims... Sorry for mispronouncing your name.
That's right. All three of petitioners' claims are procedurally barred and meritless. But before I get to that, I'd like to address the point that counsel just brought up about whether there's a discrepancy in the translation. And I should say first, the discrepancy doesn't matter for two reasons. One is the state trial court found that the translation was, in fact, verbatim. That controls under 2254E1. And that finding was well supported by the record. But aside from that, all the translation and errors in the world don't amount to a constitutional problem. Witnesses are incorrect about facts all the time. And it's not a different case here just because the witness was an officer, the topic of the testimony was the confession, and it's not different because the confession was given in Spanish. You attack those arguably incorrect testimonies attacked the same way in every case. You cross-examine, you impeach the witness's credibility, you rebut it with your own contrary testimony. And if there's a translation involved, you have an additional layer to attack. You argue that the officer didn't really understand Spanish, and you get your own independent translation. Petitioner tried all of that. It just didn't work. He had a team of two independent experts poring over this video confession with a fine-tooth comb, and all they could come up with was two things. One, in Ms. Ramos's testimony, she said that Delgadillo made unspecified omissions. Even now, we don't know what those are, so they can't have been significant, or they would have been pointed out. And the only other one is the one at the end of petitioner's reply brief. That suggests that there is one of petitioner's statements in a 30-minute confession that Delgadillo and Ramos interpreted differently. That's not significant. What Ramos testified was that translation is subjective, the point is to get the meaning across, and she said that Delgadillo's translation was verbatim. The best reading of that is that she means the meaning of his translation taken as a whole was correct. We know that Ramos agreed with Delgadillo on the critical point, which was that petitioner confessed that he entered with an intent to commit a theft. And there are two examples of that. One is at pages 931 to 32, and again at 950. Ramos testified that petitioner was asked, quote, "When you first came into the apartment, what were you looking for?" And he answered in part, quote, "I didn't even know what I was going to take." There's another one on page 950. Ramos said, he was asked, quote, "Were you looking for something to take?" Answer, "Well, possibly yes, if I had found something." So even if another statement was possibly interpreted differently by Delgadillo, Ramos agreed about these two, and that's all we need for him to say he entered with intent to commit a theft. As the state court judge found, he doesn't need a shopping list to commit residential burglary. It doesn't matter that he doesn't know what he's going to take. So for all those reasons, a translation error is not a constitutional problem anyway. It's not a coercion problem. But in any case, there really was no dispute about the critical point here. Ramos was in agreement. And I would add petitioner himself was in agreement. He acknowledged at page 965 that he did say on the video, "If I saw something I liked, I would take it." So I'll briefly address the procedural bars and the merits of the claims. The main problem with the claims is that petitioner never raised this coercion theory before. He's arguing for the first time in this court that the translation was coercive. It wasn't in the petition, so it's waived. It was never raised in state court, and so it's procedurally defaulted. He did raise a different coercion claim on post-conviction appeal, and there his counsel argued in the Finley brief that the confession, or considered arguing whether the confession was coerced because Delgadillo promised to deport petitioner. But even that different version of the claim was defaulted because he didn't raise it until post-conviction appeal, and under Illinois law, he needed to raise it on direct appeal. The Strickland claim based on the failure to raise the coercion claim based on translation has the same problem. Petitioner argued in general that counsel was ineffective, but he didn't argue that counsel should have raised this particular argument, which is a novel argument that translation is coercive police conduct. The sufficiency claim is also defaulted under the one complete round rule. Petitioner argued on direct appeal in the Anders brief, or his counsel did, that the evidence was insufficient, but he didn't argue in his direct appeal PLA that the evidence was insufficient. He did put it in the post-conviction PLA, but by then it was too late because the claim was barred by res judicata. Even aside from the defaults and the waivers, all the claims fail on the merits. The coercion claim in particular has a lot of problems. The main problem is that petitioner is asking this court to establish a new rule in the habeas context, and he can't do that under Teague against Lane. There's no rule that says an officer can't interpret a defendant's confession. Similarly, he's barred under 2254D. The state court did adjudicate the coercion claim, although it was based on a different factual allegation. It was the allegation of deportation, which the trial court found was not true. So petitioner would also have to show that that claim was resolved in a way that contradicted or unreasonably applied Supreme Court law. And of course he can't do that because there's no Supreme Court case saying officers can't translate confessions. Aside from the 2254D and Teague problems, there's a harmlessness problem. Because this is a habeas case, petitioner would have to show that the admission of the second confession had a substantial and injurious effect on the verdict. And he can't do that for a couple of reasons. One is there's the first confession, which he has never challenged. Delgadillo testified without contradiction that petitioner told him in the first confession that he entered the apartment because he was looking to steal something. Even aside from that, there are the circumstances of the entry, which are alone sufficient to show he entered with intent to commit a theft. Petitioner entered Ms. Zimali's apartment that contained items of value through a sliding glass door without authority at 2:30 in the morning. That alone is sufficient to prove that he entered with intent to commit a theft. So for all those reasons, the coercion claim fails on the merits. The Strickland claim, based on the failure to raise this particular coercion claim, fails for the same reasons. There's no authority for this type of claim, that translation is coercive. On top of that, there was the problem that petitioner never moved to exclude the confession as coerced in the first place. So if direct appeal counsel would have raised that claim, it would have been forfeited. He would have had to show it was plain error, and he couldn't do that, of course, because the second confession was harmless in light of the other evidence. The sufficiency of the evidence claim fails on the merits, too. For residential burglary, the state had to show petitioner entered with intent to commit a theft, and that was clear both from his two confessions to that effect and from the circumstances of the entry. For murder, petitioner was only sentenced for intentional murder. So to the extent he seems to be challenging felony murder, that doesn't relate to his custody. He was convicted on three theories of murder: felony murder, knowing murder, and intentional murder. The two lesser counts were merged into the most serious count, intentional murder, for purposes of sentencing, and he was only sentenced on that count. So for intentional murder, the evidence of Ms. Zamali's injuries alone is sufficient to support the confession. She was 50 years older than petitioner. She had multiple bruises and abrasions, and she had three stab wounds to the face and the arm and the chest. Petitioner stabbed her in the chest with such force that he caused massive internal hemorrhaging. Those facts alone, the nature and number of injuries, are sufficient to prove he acted with intent to kill. So unless there are questions, we'd ask, for all those reasons, that the court affirm the denial of habeas relief.
Thank you, counsel. Mr. Ewing? You have 2 minutes, Mr. Ewing.
Thank you, Your Honor. The state has raised numerous procedural default arguments, and I would suggest that they all fall for the same two fundamental reasons. First, the question is, were these issues fairly presented to the court below on direct appeal and on post-conviction appeal? It is not whether a pro se prisoner was able to write out the legal briefs with factual analysis the same way in which a trained lawyer would be, but whether they were fairly presented so that the state was on notice of what these claims would be. And I would suggest that they were, as he raised these issues, counsel raised them in the Anders brief with supporting facts. Petitioner himself raised them in his state PLA. He included them again in his post-conviction petition. Counsel referenced them in his Finley brief. And again, they were all sort of tied together in his habeas petition. The second aspect of that, though, is, as I said earlier, the question of ineffective assistance of counsel. And again, the facts of this case are obvious that they should have been brought by appellant counsel. I would turn then to the fact that we are not requesting a new rule. Here we are leaning on Supreme Court precedent that every confession must be voluntary, and that voluntariness must be assessed independently of any corroborating evidence, much of which the state has mentioned today, but that is irrelevant to whether the confession that was used against him was obtained voluntarily. And thirdly, just to address briefly the question of whether the second confession admission was harmless due to this first confession. The second confession was not harmless. Admission of it was not harmless because the first confession, the only record we have of that was the officer's testimony. Then we have petitioner Mr. Carrion did present his own testimony at trial that contradicted the officer's testimony as to the first confession. So the second confession literally was the most compelling evidence for the trial court. With that, I would ask you to overturn his conviction. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much, counsel. Mr. Ewing, were you appointed to this case?
Yes, I was.
We have the thanks of the court for your fine representation of your client. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Thanks to both counsel. The case will be taken under